This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. What was your life like 1 month ago today? Mine was pretty much exactly like it is today. But for Ukrainians, 1 month ago today, February 23rd, was the last day they could casually chat with neighbors, hurry their children to school, enjoy a cup of coffee at their favorite cafe without worry, or take a walk in the park in peace. Because the next day, February 24th, Russia began its attack on Ukraine. So now, some of those neighbors are dead. Some schools empty. The cafes reduced to rubble. The parks silent. Human beings are darkly masterful at inflicting cruelty and suffering on one another, but they are also ferocious survivors. Just listen to Olga Tokariuk on how Ukrainian kids are getting an education.
We are also trying to make some, you know, routine for children here, even in this like circumstances. Okay, there is no like the schools and the kindergartens are not functioning properly, but there is like online learning. So in the first like few weeks of war, we didn't do like any schooling. We didn't like pressure children. We didn't tell them, you know, like go to study. Okay, the air alert is over now. So I was saying that, you know, we're not like putting pressure on kids like that you have to like study online, because that's like, it's been long with COVID. It's very difficult, like all these online studies. So we kind of made a vacation for them for a couple of weeks.
Olga Tokariuk is in Western Ukraine. Well, joining me now from Lviv is Ivan Gomza. He's a professor of political science at the Kyiv School of Economics. And he's now living, as I said, in Lviv. Ivan Gomza, welcome to you. Ivan, can you hear me? Things are uncertain.
I'm here. I can hear you. I can hear you loud and clear.
Ah, okay. So let me just see. Perhaps we have a long delay problem. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Ah, wonderful. Okay. Honestly, Ivan, given the fact that there's a war going on in Ukraine, I had my heart in my throat there for a moment, thinking that something actually terrible had happened to you. I'm very glad that that is not the case. Can you tell me, first of all, what did you do on February 23rd? How did you spend that day?
Well, actually, it is hard to remember precisely or even imprecisely. But since I can remember some kind of routine, I'm pretty sure that I took my girl to the kindergarten, to the daycare center. And also I might have, I don't know, written an article or read some book, something like that, because I used to teach at a university. So there is always something to read and to write for us professors.
It sounds beautifully normal, honestly. And at what point in time over the course of the day of February 23rd, did you and your family realize something had to change?
Well, here we have actually to separate 2 days. I mean, the one I have described you just now, it is like the last normal day. And I actually don't remember whether it was the 23rd or 24th. But the very first day when everything started, actually it started, I was sleeping and my wife, she woke me up at 5 a.m. and I literally remember her words. So, Ivan, get out of the bed. Putin is declaring war on Ukraine. So then we tuned on our smartphones and watched the declaration of war by President of Russia. And then everything went really, really not in the routine-like style.
Mm. You've written that you stopped your clock at 5 a.m.
Yeah, I did.
And why did you do that?
Well, just as I put it on the paper, because I wanted to be a symbol, it is like, you know, normal life has finished. And then either I come back and I restart it, or there is nothing to come back for.
Hmm. It's hard for me to imagine sitting here in the peace and security of Boston, Massachusetts, the kind of instantaneous mental change that has to happen when you realize that your nation is under military attack. I mean, Can you tell me, after your wife said that and you watched the Putin video, like, what did you instantly know what to do next, and what did you do?
Well, actually, it's a kind of a misrepresentation that that was a watershed day, because there was information, a kind of intelligence leaks, that there might be an attack. I mean, we were on, you know, on the knives, put it like that, let's put it that way. So we were ready for a kind of bad action since December. Mm-hmm. And actually, the December and January, we spent, you know, like, storing food. We had a decent storage of flour, of water in our apartment. So it was not like, you know, oh, goodbye, the peaceful days. Actually, the war is going on for 8 years in Ukraine. Kyiv was peaceful. It was absolutely peaceful. And no one, I mean, neither the government, nor citizens, nor I personally, we expected the attack to be directly at Kyiv. So I'm a political scientist, hell yes. I expected that the attack will be somewhere in Donetsk region. Maybe they will try, maybe they would try, the Russians, I mean, to capture Mariupol, something like that. So I didn't expect them to try to capture Kyiv. And that is, you know, that is the difficult synthesis of normalcy and abnormalcy, of unexpected and expected. So we expected the war. We expected, you know, some kind of warfare. We didn't expect it to come directly to our apartment. That's what I'm trying to say when I say that there is no watershed moment. Because then in that the very first day of the war, since those 5 a.m. when we woke up, we actually were still thinking, what should we do? It was like my wife, she said, okay, let's go to Lviv, because she's from Lviv. And I was like lingering, and I was, you know, like postponing the decision. I was thinking about something like, well, we have water, we have supplies here. We have a bike here. You know, sometimes a bike is a kind of a transportation. So we have everything here. Why should we go? It's better to stay here. It's like we have more chances being here. We know the city and so on and so. And then in the middle of the day, when we saw the development of the situation, we saw the commandos redeployed near Hostomel Airport. It was like, okay, let's get out of here.
Yeah.
So that was that watershed moment.
Yeah.
Not the war has come, but we had to get out.
Yeah. It makes perfect sense to me, right? Because I think it's deeply human to have an intellectual understanding of something happening, but still holding on until perhaps the last second to the hope that it's not going to happen to you, right? You said you knew there was a war coming, but you didn't know for sure if it would come to your apartment. I completely understand that. It's a deeply human thing. And so then when you left, I mean, you wrote about how you could have either gone by train or by car. And can you explain why you ended up going by car and taking your parents as well?
Well, it is a kind of a serendipitous event, because I mean, I don't drive, and it was really impossible to find a taxi to get, you know, with some luggage and a cat and a baby to get to the railway. So we called our parents, and we called again, because at 5, let's say 5:30, we called them after we watched the video, and I told them, okay, guys, the war arrived. Shall we go somewhere? Shall we go to Lviv? And my father, he put it, I remember, in those very words, he put it, well, I have to go to my plant. I have to go to work. And by the way, he is an engineer at Antonov aircraft plant, the one which has been bombed then. So it was like he declined my proposition, and we decided to take train, but there was no chance to get to the railway. So I called him back, and he arrived to take us. And then while we were driving to the railway, we actually convinced them not to stay here in Kyiv and to go with us. So we drove back to their apartment, grabbed some clothes of theirs, and then we started our ordeal.
Yeah. And you write about how you chose a more southern and then western route to get from Kyiv to Lviv, and that the other route that you could have taken was actually bombed by the Russians. Can you just briefly tell me, where did you spend that first night?
Well, actually, we were lucky because we spent it, we crashed into an apartment of a relative of our ex-schoolmate, something like that. So it was like the big city of Vinnytsia. It's an oblast center. So it's like, you know, it's like Baltimore for Maryland. And it was like midnight. My dad was very tired after driving. And so we understood that there is no chance actually to drive further. Moreover, most of the distance has not been yet covered. So we decided we have to sleep somewhere in Vinnytsia, and then we remembered that we had a schoolmate, yes, who used to live there. So she might have a relative, and it actually turned out to be true. So yes, we crashed into an apartment of actually unknown to us, total strangers.
And you say that there was a moment that night where there was an air raid siren, and you and your friends' friends all had to gather in their basement, total strangers, just 3 hours before, sheltering from a potential attack. I mean, what did that feel like?
Well, it was weird because we arrived at 1 a.m. We slept till 4 a.m. And then when, you know, the lady of the house knocked on the door and I woke up, don't forget my previous night was sleepless as well, yes, mm-hmm. because it was the night of the war declaration. So I woke up and what? And she's telling something like air raid. What the hell? We are in Vinnytsia. What kind of air raid? So it was unbelievable that they can reach to Vinnytsia. But actually, they did it. They did it. They launched a kind of a tactical missile, and they covered, they targeted part of the city.
Mm. Well, Ivan Gomza, hold on here for just a minute. This hour, we're just listening to Ukrainians on how they've survived the past month. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're listening to Ukrainians, civilian Ukrainians, on what it's taken for them to survive this past month of shattering war in Ukraine. And, you know, it occurs to me that there are a lot of On Point listeners out there listening now, you who are potentially also civilian survivors of various wars around the country. So if any of this is really hitting home for you, hop on social media, on Facebook or Twitter. We're at On Point Radio. And let us know what your experience like was as a civilian in the midst of a war. What did it take for you to survive, not just physically, but mentally, spiritually? And what would you tell the people of Ukraine now? So again, we're at On Point Radio at Twitter and at Facebook. I'm joined today by Ivan Gomza. He's currently living in Lviv, so he's an internally displaced Ukrainian. He was in Kyiv. He's a professor of political science at the Kyiv School of Economics. And let's listen to a moment to Olga Buzunova, co-founder of the Ukraine Witness Project. They're keeping a video archive of scenes from daily life during the war. Now, she sent her husband and son away, but she has remained in Kyiv. And here's a moment where she describes what it's like to drive in the city and how to make your way through tank traps in the street.
You have to go slalom, because otherwise you cannot pass. And many of the drivers didn't see that, and they were just hitting through that, because it was in the night. So when within the first week, I was driving through the city, and I saw like many of the cars. So, well, it's something of a movie, let's say, when you drive through the city, which is without people, nobody in the street. a few cars and you are driving and you see these cars broken and they are still there because nobody takes them out.
That's Olga Buzunova, co-founder of Ukraine, the Ukraine Witness Project. Now, we heard a moment ago from Olga Tokariuk. Now, she fled the fighting in Kyiv with her daughter. She's now in Western Ukraine. And she says part of the challenge of making it through a day is simply not knowing what will happen tomorrow.
No place is 100% safe now in Ukraine. So we kind of think, okay, thankfully nothing has happened here yet. But it's yet, and we don't know, you know, when it might change from one day or another. And of course, like, we are making plans B and plan C, what we're going to do and whether we will have time to, you know, flee to the border, take like kids, and should we pack like another go bag just to be ready?
Yvonne Gomza, let me just quickly ask you, you're in the relative safety for now, thankfully, in Lviv. But do you feel the same way that Olga just described about having to have lots of plans in your head for what might happen next?
Yeah, actually, it's truly that way. I mean, on the one hand, we got used not to have any plans. I mean, not to think what are we going to do the next weekend, whether we are going to go to a movie and so on. So, but on the other hand, we have like the big plan. I mean, if the situation goes south, if the Russian comes south, let's put it that way, or west, if they come to Lviv, we actually have to have a second plan and a contingency plan how to move further, how to get out of the harm's way. So it is the only plan we can have.
What kind of toll does the uncertainty take on you?
Ooh, wow, you need to be a psychiatrist actually to make that kind of assessment. But actually, yes, it is difficult. I mean, there is a kind of, you know, it's like jumping. When you jump, you can fly high. And sometimes during the war, you feel that feeling of high. I mean, it's like, oh, we are winning. Or maybe at least we killed some bastards and so on and so on. And then there are other days when you are going down, you are sinking into despair. You think that hell, this will go on for months, years, who knows? Who knows whether the bomb will fall on you? So it is difficult. It's like, you know, oscillation. That is the word. Yes, let's put it that way. It's like emotional oscillation. Mm-hmm. It is between hope and despair.
Mm. Well, Yvonne, hang on here for just a minute, because I would like to bring Alevtina Kahidze into the conversation now. She lives in a village close to Kyiv. And she's a visual artist, lives in the village with her husband and three dogs. One of the front lines of fighting is only about 4 miles away from her home. Alevtina, hello, can you hear me?
Hello?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I do.
Hi, thank you so much for speaking with me today. First of all, Alevtina, you're only about 4 miles away from one of the areas of fighting. Can you see, hear the shelling?
I hear shelling each 20 minutes. I think something like that.
Every 20 minutes, all day and all night?
Exactly. I'm totally zombie, I think. Yes, it is. Maybe when I'm laughing, it's kind of a way to defense my own psychic or something like this.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel it as well?
I already can make some categorization of shelling. Some of them I'm used to already. Some of them pretty heavy, and my body became very hot. So it depends. And I already can define the weapon which is used.
You can,
different sound.
So you know.
It's also different vibration.
I see. So it's been going on so frequently and for so long, you already can tell the differences between the types of artillery that are being used. Tell me more about how it feels in your body.
Just caught. I can't explain more than saying that, like, you have high temperature or something like this.
And you have four dogs. How do they, what happens to them every 20 minutes when all the, you can hear and feel the shelling?
I have three dogs.
Three dogs.
And they react differently. Female dog try to be near me. And if I put her in a house, she's pretty okay. But male dogs, they like to fight. They bark, trying really to do something. And then they are absolutely exhausted and again come to me. So actually, they like to be near us, near me and my husband. So they're absolutely exhausted. And I feel really guilt in front of them because this war is not dog war. It's human war.
You feel guilty for your animals.
Yeah.
So, Alevtina, with shelling going on every 20 minutes, as you described, what do you do in a typical day? Can you describe to me how you spend your day?
Oh, my God. I never had so lot of things to do. I have so many interviews and also so many requests to send my drawings. I do draw from morning until evening. And when it's dark, we can't use light. So I do produce text on my computer in a cellar, which I prepared. So I'm working as an artist, always was worked, but more recused.
And what are you drawing?
Everything what I do feel, it's like to reflect reality and then transmit this reality on paper. I produce diary of wartime.
Can you describe to me what one of your drawings looks like that you made, say, this week?
Ah, okay. Like yesterday, I made a drawing. It's actually self-portrait. And I'm standing on the earth and plants I round, and it's written, "This world is broken. No safe place is anymore anywhere. That's why I stand as plant and do not run."
Can you tell me how you made the decision with your husband to not leave your village?
Probably you will judge me that we are crazy, but from the other hand, look, it's not a solution if everyone will run away. It's just not possible that whole population of Ukraine, 42 million, can go somewhere.
I don't think you're crazy. I mean, I will not judge anybody who has to make a decision like that in a war. I just wonder, do you have everything right now that you need to survive for a long time? Is your water still running? Do you have adequate food? Can you describe that to me?
Actually, we have electricity. As you can notice, we have internet.
Yeah.
And look, many of my neighbors left the village and they left me key. And I have duty to feed the animals, aquarium fish, tortoise, cats, also water plants. And I have got a lot of refrigerators with their food. And they all phone me and say, "Alevtina, take whatever you want." Of course, we don't have croissants, but whatever you find in our fridges, please take. So I have not one refrigerator, but as I just described, many. So we haven't visited any supermarket from 24 of February. We don't have a very wide menu. But we are fine. But anyway, I actually lost 5 kilograms since the war started. And it's not because I'm hungry. It's just probably my body reacted on the situation like this, make me more light.
Alevtina, you're an artist, so drawing and making art clearly gives you meaning and joy, right, in your life. What else are you able to do now, Alevtina, that makes you feel human and joyful even as the shelling happens every 20 minutes.
Now, as I described, I helped my neighbors to run their houses, as I just described, to care about the animals. So I helped them. They have to feel better, safe. So it's solidarity. And secondly, I also pack my art in wood boxes. I do it every day with carefully writing down what I put in which box. So I'm not so crazy. I value the art I produced during 20 years. And I try to do whatever I can in the situation I have in order to save it. So I'm packing things. Mm. So this is my job for every day.
Yeah, I understand. I mean, trying to save things also includes putting your digital files into the cloud in case your computer gets destroyed, right?
I'm doing this, thank you, to Apple company. I bought extra space since it started, and a friend of mine from Kyiv, he's running my computer. He's doing all stuff in order to put all my digital files to iCloud. And of course, I'm in contact with amazing curator who does live in Switzerland, who has all my key in case if something happens. So she will run my art.
Yeah. Well, Ivan Gomza, I hope you're still connected here with us.
Yes, I am.
Good. I'm curious. I asked Alevtina a question that I'd love to ask you as well, because as we're talking about the normal, quote unquote, normal rhythms of daily life are completely shattered by war. And yet people can and must continue in order to survive, find even in the smallest ways, the things that continue to give them joy. I'm wondering what in Lviv, as an internally displaced person, still, like, what are the things that you and your family are able to do every day that give you a little bit of joy or that sense of humanity?
Well, that is a good question, because as a professor, yes, as a university teacher, my biggest joy, two biggest joy of my life were to teach and to read books, I mean. And actually now universities are dispersed and displaced, and the students are partially in the army, partially they went abroad just to get shelter. So we don't teach now. So the war robbed that part of joy from my life. And actually I am not able to read either, because I have a very interesting book about the Taiping uprising. I wanted to read it really badly. I mean, I bought it for a Kindle edition, and I wanted to read it, and now I have some time to do it. But actually, I cannot turn the Kindle pages. It doesn't resonate with me anymore. I mean, why should I read about Chinese history of the 19th century? And there is something which is, you know, unraveling my life here in Ukraine, the 21st century. So going back to your question, what actually we do, how can we bring actually not normalcy, but some sense into our life, some meaning? Because, you know, when your life is meaningless, there is no point in living. So I am actually doing what I can do best. I mean, I'm a political scientist, and I'm, by the way, my field of expertise are social movements and political extremism. So I'm writing text about what is going on, about Russian imperialism and the nature of war, about war crimes committed by Putin. I'm writing them in English so that people can read. And I'm a member of scholarly network, so we actually discuss it there.
Yeah. Well, Ivan Gomza and Alevtina Kahidze, hang on for just one moment. We have to take another quick break, but we'll hear more from you when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university. shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're listening to two Ukrainians talk to us, describe to us what it's been like surviving emotionally, physically, and spiritually the last month of war. Ivan Gomza joins us. He's a professor of political science at the Kyiv School of Economics. He and his family fled Kyiv, and they're now living in Lviv. Alevtina Kahidza joins us. She has remained in her village near Kyiv with her family and their dogs, one of the front lines of fighting between the Russian military and Ukrainians is about 4 miles away from her home. Let's listen once again to Olga Tokariuk. She told us about one of the hardest things that she's had to experience in the past month. And again, she's a journalist currently in Western Ukraine.
The worst thing is like watching your old photos. You know, my daughter the other day, she was on my cell phone scrolling like to the photos from pre-war in Kyiv, you know, in our balcony. All the like nice little things we were doing together, going out, you know, for walks in the city center, to Christmas markets, to, you know, do some ice skating.
So memories of things lost, very hard to endure. We also spoke with Andriy Kozinchuk. He serves in the Ukrainian army as a psychologist.
I'm a military psychologist, but I am a shooter. I have a gun and I have grenades and so on.
Now, in this war, he decided he should counsel not just soldiers, but civilians too, on how to cope with death, fear, and exhaustion. So Andriy posted a video online titled How Not to Go Crazy During the War. And we reached him outside of Kyiv, where he's based with his unit.
Seeing like people dying or see dead people, this is psychotraumatic situation for you. And it's not normal, because normal life, it's about life. You have to focus in your life things. It's really, really sad about that. And you have to have a time to think about that, that this is really sad, this is really bad. And after that, you have to create a plan how you will live. What about your life? Not about death. But when you have a plan, what to do today, what to do next week, what to do next year, your brain will be focused on next mission, how to live with it. Because we can change this situation. You have right to have emotions, a lot of emotions. You can be happy. Yes, this is war, but you can be happy. You can have some joy of something. You can laugh. Eat delicious food, to have sex, to hold your cat, and so on. Be happy, please. Express your emotions outside. It's not okay to keep your emotions inside you, because this energy will destroy you step by step. So you can cry with tears, you can sing songs, or just smile, or to sit sad. Next thing, it's about rest. Because if you are sitting and surfing your mobile and looking for news, it's not rest. You have to care about yourself at first. But after that, if you are in some safety zone, you can take care about the people that are around you. This is really good for you because you are feeling they are a good person, and this is real good for people around you because they feeling that they are unique and they are important. For therapy, we have to finish the war. After finishing the war, we will have rehabilitation, therapy, everything.
Andriy Kozinchuk, military psychologist, with his advice for his fellow Ukrainians on how not to go crazy during the war. And again, we reached him outside of Kyiv, where he's based with his unit. Alevtina, hope you can still hear me, because I'm curious to know, do you allow yourself even to think about what you will do when the war ends?
Oh, I have a lot of plans, really. I think if I don't have any dreams, instead dream to end the war, it's stupid just to dream about ending the war. Of course, I have not to limit myself. The war broke a lot of my plans. So the first things in the list, just to do what I planned. And then more things I can add. I have time now to dream. And I dream even for whole world, I must say. I really, really sure that something is wrong with the world. I believe if this war would be end, must there are new institutions, new rules. I'm not a politician, but still, as an artist, I can imagine new institutions, new organizations. This give me energy. So if I'm alive, until end of my life, I will talk that we haven't had just a local war. We had just a war. And not only in Ukraine we have war, many wars are around planet. And I don't think it's actually the way as humans should act.
Yeah. You know, a little earlier in the program today, Ivan reminded us that in a sense, he said, in a sense, there's been war going on in Ukraine since 2014 for 8 years. That is very true in your life, Alevtina, right? Can you tell us what happened to your mother in 2014?
Yeah, but it's also part of this story. Yeah. Actually, if somebody would be intrigued or confused how I can talk about the situation we have had now near Kyiv, why I am so sure, why I'm not scared, because I'm divorced since 2014. And my mom was in occupied territory for 5 years. And I learned a lot from her. She told me how she was hiding in a cellar. She told me how she was doing her stuff in a garden. And then suddenly the shelling started. So she gave me the experience through words. But I remembered everything, even if she couldn't somehow give me the experience which she couldn't actually somehow to transmit. For instance, she also said to me that she already knew it, what kind of weapon is used, Grady, I don't know how it's in English, or another way of weapon or type of weapon. And now I remember everything what she told me, and I'm very like her. Now I also can define what kind of weapon is used. Not, I mean, the type, the name. I just remember the sound. So, and it's again about Ukrainians and about many of my friends around and whole nation. So we are in pretty hard history since 2013 when we actually have had a long-term protest, which we called Revolution of Dignity or Euromaidan. So since the time, we have forgotten life which is peaceful. This is our reality. And we already used many things to complain. We stopped to complain. I started to put a lot of humor about the situation in my works and also in my drawings and also in my performances. And even now I can make some humor.
Yeah.
My friend, a curator of the Museum for Contemporary Art in Belgium, in Antwerp, she phoned me and asked me, Alevtina, you're going to have birthday tomorrow. What do you want? I said, of course, send me croissant and Belgium chocolate. And actually, he did.
Yeah.
He sent. And another friend of mine from Switzerland, I studied with him in Maastricht in the Netherlands in 2004, 2005. He also asked me how he can help. And I also said, send me some sweet chocolate. And he did.
Yes. Alevtina, just to be clear for a moment, when you said your mother was in Donetsk, right, in 2014, and all the, you're telling all the things that she told you about what taught you about what she was experiencing. She also died, right?
Yes, she just died on the checkpoint of our new border, or we also use another name, contact line. She just died because her heart stopped working. It was in 2019, and she died on the territory of occupied area. And I didn't go there. I was afraid because it's really occupied territory was. And the international organization brought me her body. And actually, I bury her in the village where I am now. Hmm. So... And I worked for the memorial for her. And actually, the memorial was also an artwork. And since her home, her house kept her there, I symbolically made her house in the cemetery where she's lying in the time now. Well, so it's one of my... artistic statement that I respect her decision not to move from her hometown, but not Donetsk, it's actually Zhdanivka.
I see. Well, Ivan Gomza, we have only about 1 minute left. I just wonder, as a last thought, what you think is most important for listeners outside of Ukraine who have been hearing you and Alevtina this hour. What do you think they need to understand about day-to-day life in Ukraine right now?
Actually, it is not about the day-to-day life in Ukraine. There is something they should understand, but about the meaning of the war. I mean, we discussed for an hour, we are discussing for an hour, that one day your life can be completely unraveled. So don't think that the war is something going somewhere in Iraq, Philippines, or Ukraine. Actually, it's war which can one day, and according to Putin, maybe not the day which is far away, come much closer to your borders, get prepared, and since someone is being fighting, actually consider him, them, us, I mean, as your allies.
Well, Ivan Gomza, professor of political science at the Kyiv School of Economics, now with his family in Lviv. Thank you so much, Ivan, for sharing your life with us today. And Alevtina Kahidze, again, in a village near Kyiv, a visual artist as well. Alevtina, thank you so much for sharing your life with us as well. Now, I want to just take the last few minutes of the show to turn to Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst, who's actually been listening along this whole hour. Jack, reflect on what you've heard about Ukrainians, but you know, civilians more generally, and the immense burden they carry in war.
Well, we've heard from the front line of this war, and indeed the front lines of 21st century war. In World War I, there was one civilian casualty for every 8 or 9 soldier casualties. In the 21st century, that is reversed. There are 9 civilian casualties for every soldier casualty. You see that in the Iraq War, 2,400 American dead, an estimated 200,000 Iraqi dead. Truly, for civilians, in war, any area where war is going on, what Aleftina said is true. No safe place is anywhere, anymore, anywhere.
Mm, that's a very grim reversal of a ratio, Jack. I mean, but and yet, so it continues to happen. Civilians have always been, in a sense, they have been targets in wars, even though that is clearly a war crime now. Can you talk more about that?
Well, I mean, partly it's a matter of the nature of warfare, how distant it is from, you know, front lines and soldiers facing each other. It's also the temptation, really the terrible moral temptation of strategic bombing, of bombing the enemy's homeland, bombing his civilians in an effort to force a decision. The record of World War II is clear that didn't happen in Germany, despite losing 500,000 to Allied bombing civilians. Mr. Putin, however, might well look at Japan and reflect that, well, Japan surrendered after the atomic bomb, and that could well be a temptation for him to use some sort of nuclear demonstration.
But of course, in 1945, Japan couldn't mount a symmetrical response. The situation is quite different now. But Jack, you know, I'm just wondering why there seems to be this belief, you know, with Hiroshima and Nagasaki aside, because of the uniqueness of that event, that you can cow a people by murdering enough of them. Has history borne that out to be true?
It hasn't. That was one of the expectations of the early sort of grandfathers of air power, Billy Mitchell in America and others. They said this will essentially force people to march on their governments and call a halt, surrender. But Winston Churchill said no. In fact, it might have the opposite effect, that they would be rendered the more desperately resolved by efforts to kill them. And of course, he tested that hypothesis himself in World War II with the daylight bombing of German cities.
Well, and he saw the resolve in the Blitz on London, and we're seeing that same resolve today in Ukraine. Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.